Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this April the 13th on the West Coast, now April the 14th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. I'd like to welcome all those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world. Some of you folks missed me yesterday, I understand. I was indisposed and couldn't be on the air with Drew Raines. However, I plan on being with him next week, so I appreciate all the concern. I'm fine, doing well. Lots of new discoveries. Also, we want to welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network. Well, there's a lot going on, and I suppose we'll talk about some of what's going on internationally, especially this plane crash in Poland that looks pretty nasty. Looks like some government actually created this, and we know that this has occurred. In fact, I was thinking of this earlier this evening, listening to another show where they were talking about this topic for about 2 hours. The plane crash at Katyn, which was commemorating the 70-year-old massacre of Poles in what was then Soviet Russia, and what is certainly acting like Soviet Russia. Now, the Russians supposedly rehabbed this airplane, overhauled it, and did some maintenance work on it in December of 2009, and that plane was in Poland. I don't know how much it was used, but it's quite possible that someone could have put a device on it to cause it to explode in midair, like the planes that have been doing the same thing in the United States over a period of time. I recall Beverly Eckert's flight in, I think it was February of 2009, if I remember correctly. Maybe it was even before that. Oh, heck. There have been so many of these plane crashes, but certainly the descriptions that the media gave us were nothing like what actually occurred. There were people on the ground and people who had witnessed the crash itself or had seen a flaming, burning plane coming into a neighborhood before it hit two houses. The media said it only hit one house. There was a huge pit in what might have been the basement of the house, as if the plane exploded and virtually incinerated. Now, that doesn't normally happen in a plane crash. You can still tell it was a plane. And in that particular event, we did some research and found out all the witnesses, the eyewitnesses that were interviewed by the media, by and large, were part of a ring connected to the plane crash itself. And we could tell that because these people gave their addresses, and it turned out none of them lived where they said they lived, that none of them would have seen it other than having foreknowledge that it was going to occur. And this has been a repeated pattern. I wouldn't put it past certain intelligence groups to have sabotaged that plane to make it look like the Soviet Union did it, or I should say Russia would have done it. We don't know for sure, but that's a possibility, and I haven't heard that discussed by anybody. But those that make the money in these crashes, according to David Hawkins and Field McConnell, who have been on this show a few times, actually Sidley Austin is behind that, and a bunch of other airline companies, one particular company in Canada, for example. So as time goes on, we will investigate that deeper. I can tell you that reports are coming out that there was no fog at 11 in the morning. And also I've heard reports that for the plane to have clipped trees, because the airport itself is up on a plateau, the trees would have to be 400 feet high. So that said, we're going to bring on tonight's guest. He has a very good research website, one of the best in the world, very high rankings, and he contributes to that site as well as many other journalists from around the world, and covers just about every topic you can imagine. And he's a frequent guest here on Evident Footprints, and I'm proud to call him my friend, fellow researcher, web host of educate-yourself.org, my good friend Ken Adachi. Ken, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Thank you, Don. Wonderful to be on again with you.
Well, what's on your mind tonight? Let me ask you that. There's so much news out there, and as usual, they just keep it churning, don't they?
Yeah, I haven't. I'm gonna bring up a new topic tonight, one I've never discussed before, either with you or even on my website. But it's a very important topic, and I think people will find this very interesting, extremely interesting. Just for a moment on the Polish plane crash. I didn't read the details of the story, but I did see the headlines of the crash at Rents.com. And naturally, the first thing that pops into your mind is it seems too suspicious for the president of a country, along with some major portion of his government, to first all be on the same plane, but two, you don't expect a natural crash under those circumstances. While it's possible, the likelihood of a planned engineered crash is much greater. I don't know the details of the man's life or his work, but he obviously upset somebody. Do you know how high the plane was when the problem occurred? Was it very high up or taking off or what?
Well, we've heard various accounts. First of all, they say the plane clipped trees, okay, after making four attempted landings. In fact, they were one account says that they were about to be redirected to Minsk, Belarus.
Okay.
And they as far as I know, they were having difficulty with the plane. Now, there was a member of parliament, the Polish parliament, had taken a train and was there at the airport waiting for them to arrive. Mm-hmm. And he says the skies were blue and clear. Mm-hmm. The initial reports were the plane crashed because of fog. Mm-hmm. So how high the plane was, I couldn't tell you. But from the descriptions that I read about the airport, it's up on a plateau, which is 150 feet higher than anything else around that area mm-hmm. where the airport mm-hmm. is. So right. Imagine it's almost like an island.
Right.
It would be like crashing into the ocean and bouncing up and hitting trees in the water before you right. land on the ground.
Right.
They say the plane skidded some 500 feet on the runway. Seems like it would skid a lot longer. Being the craft that it was, that's nothing. That's a second and a half for an airplane right. to cover that speed.
Right. Since you're telling me, then the indications are that the fog report is not true. And number two, if there was fog, this is 2010. They've had all modern craft are computer controlled. On landing and they've had the capabilities for 70 years now to land a craft, an airplane in fog. It's called instrument landing, but assuming that, there isn't a thunderstorm or really turbulent weather to prevent you from making a landing, commercial airliners for 70 years perhaps have had the capability to land in fog. It doesn't have to be a visual landing for it to work, because it's all computer controlled. So in either case, they're trying to look for a pretext to hang the crash on. I mentioned to you on in other talks we've done a while back that the inner government and certain groups, such as the group that funded the Montauk Project, et cetera, have had at their disposal since the early 1970s, technology in which they can cause a commercial airliner to either crash on takeoff or landing. They can direct a energy, a handheld or shoulder carried, I should say, a weapon that could be aimed at a craft. This is in the early 70s now.
Mm-hmm.
It could be aimed at a craft, and it's sending some sort of ultrasonic energy beam that's causing a structural failure of the aircraft. And many crashes, in fact, have been caused by this device. I mentioned to you that Otto Skorzeny had a conversation, you know, the ex-commando, Nazi commando,
mm-hmm.
World War II, who we've talked about many times because of the information he passed on to Eric Orion just prior to his reported death in December of 1999. He had had a conversation with a person, I believe in the late 70s, 78, 80, somewhere around there, and a audio tape was made of that conversation. And in the late 80s, 88, 89, that the text from that conversation was made available to a guy named, eventually made available to a guy named Jim Keith, who himself had died under very mysterious circumstances around the year 2000 or so. But Jim Keith had authored a number of very important books revealing the NWO game plan. And in one of these books, he has a chapter called The Nazi International. And in that chapter of the book, Otto Skorzeny, in this taped conversation, as I mentioned, originally taped in the late 70s, he discusses exactly how this technology is applied to planes, and that a number of planes had been taken down in order to essentially cause great concern for a certain aircraft company. For instance, the Germans were funding were trying to get off the ground the Airbus, which is a consortium, I think, of France, Britain, and Germany. And their big competitor, I think it was McDonnell Douglas. I could be mistaken that with Boeing, but I think it was McDonnell Douglas. And what he told this person he had this interview with is that they essentially were sending a signal to these folks that, you know, back off, let them get develop their airframe, and these crashes won't keep on happening. It was a blackmail effort, and it worked quite well because what they had hoped to accomplish, they did accomplish, and the aircraft company backed off as planned, and this European consortium, which had a domination of the German part, eventually was able to develop the airframes that they wanted to, you know, have successfully compete in. And hopefully overshadow the big American aircraft developers. So this technology has been around for 40 to 50 years. So it's not a big deal for them if they use this to take down a craft. And particularly on takeoff and landing in good weather, it happened to a Spanish airline 2 or 3 years ago. I can't remember exactly. But there was somebody or some persons who were aboard that particular flight that they wanted to eliminate. So they just took down the whole plane. So I'm only speculating, of course, but I'm very suspicious that this plane, probably was a result of an engineered crash.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you remember the French plane that exploded over the Atlantic Ocean after having left Brazil.
Brazil, right.
And mm-hmm. and that was during a time, in fact, I think I mentioned that on the show last night. The Brazilian government and the central bank were expected to kick in $1 trillion into, you know, the derivative hedge fund right. Ponzi schemes in New York. And they were trying to pressure them to do that. And evidently there were at least, as I recall, there was something like 26 French intelligence agents on that plane as well.
Wow.
And, you know, there were problems at the time because word had it that Nicolas Sarkozy, the Hungarian French president, actually was being pressured by the powers that be internationally over the G20 meetings about the hijacking of the Freedom and Prosperity Funds and all these international tier 1 through 10 payments that were going on. Remember, it's always chase the money, follow the money, mm-hmm. and you get there. This would be the perfect pretext to try to make it look like the Soviets did this this crash. And I keep calling them Soviets. I guess that's because, in a sense, they still are. They're acting like it.
Yes.
And in fact, I've come to the conclusion that Wantagate was about the repayment of all the munitions we gave the Soviet Union during World War II under the auspices of the UN Lend-Lease program. So this is something that's been hidden from the people, and it's come out pretty recently and really connects the dots as to what's going on. There, you know, Putin is expecting a reported $30 billion kickback out of this money that was taken by destabilizing the ruble, the $27.5 trillion of the Leo Wanta money. But while they keep regurgitating that old lie, it's deflecting attention away from the fact that they have actually gotten into the trillions, hundreds of trillions of dollars in Ponzi schemes, and that the Federal Reserve is probably upside down to the tune of $5, maybe $5.5 quadrillion. And they're reporting on the news that the economy is on an upswing, that the stock market is rising. You know, it's just one lie after another. Mm-hmm. But this all connects together. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Right.
So this could easily have been the CIA that did this to make it look like the Russians actually caused this. You see, mm-hmm. just to create dissension. And the president of Georgia says that something very evil has occurred here. Of course, he didn't elucidate on that.
Right.
So that's my 2 cents on that.
Yeah. Yeah,
so three cents.
Yeah, we can see the pattern. You know, it's clear. We see the same pattern: problem, reaction, solution. False flag is the modus operandi that they've been using for many decades. So, I think more and more people of the general population who don't necessarily pay attention to what is called conspiracy type websites are beginning to see the picture. I notice there's more and more people who seem to be waking up to the reality of chemtrails. It's too bad. It takes 13, 14 years for people to see it. I guess I should say 13, but that's the way it goes. However, though, you notice the recognition is growing. It's showing up more often on mainstream news. TV newscast, etc. The weatherman. I just posted something earlier today in which it was various YouTube clips of weathermen referring to the satellite photos that clearly show chemtrail fallout, and they're saying to the audience, the TV audience, well, this is actually the military dropping a fine metal. They call it chaff, and yada yada yada.
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Mainstream weathermen on mainstream TV stations openly admitting it, it's finally becoming more of a recognized topic. But what I like to do is I like to take the balance of the show, though, to talk about a new topic That is, the information has been around for easily, let's say, well, it really took off in the early 1920s, we'll say. So, you know, it's been around for 90 years or so. However, this topic that I'm going to talk about has been severely suppressed, especially in America, especially in the United States. I'm talking about a topic that's called radionics. It really began, the study of this phenomena had its roots in the early part of the 20th century with a man named Dr. Albert Abrams. He was born in San Francisco, so he's born here in California. He came from a relatively wealthy Jewish family, and he was something of a prodigy as a young person. He was very advanced in his schooling, so much so that he studied to learn to speak German, and he went and attended the University of Heidelberg in Germany and graduated with the highest honors that the school afforded. And the remarkable thing is he did it at the age of 19. Now, most of us are, you know, our first year in college at 19. Here he finished and graduated the highest honors possible. So he was an exceptional individual. And while he was in Germany, he had sought out the advice and mentoring of Helmholtz. Heinrich Helmholtz was a very famous physicist and, you know, one of the greatest scientists from Germany of the latter half of the 19th century and early of half of the 20th century. And Helmholtz cared about him, and he sort of acted as a mentor, probably because he was such a, you know, Abrams was such a smart fellow, but he seemed to be so dedicated to the whole field of science. Well, from Germany, Abrams spent a considerable amount of time studying the other major capitals of Europe, Italy, France, England. So he had quite a well-rounded, you know, intensive education and postgraduate work, obtained a doctorate degree, etc. And he came back and, he came back and he taught. He was teaching. He became a professor at Stanford Medical, and he then got a graduate degree there. So as a very young man, he had obtained very high ranking in academia, was a well-respected scientist, physician, and he started a practice in which he was very adept at diagnostic work, and he was especially skilled at something they called percussive testing. Now, we've all seen this, or you've experienced this with a doctor sometime in your life, in which the doctor might take two fingers of his left hand, the forefinger and the middle finger, and put it against your abdomen, for instance, or your back, it depends. And then with the forefinger and the middle finger of the right hand, he would tap on the two left-hand fingers that are touching the abdomen. And that sort of percussion work, and very often modern doctors will put a stethoscope to the body to amplify the sound. But it's not necessary. If you practice this technique, you can hear that there is sort of a clear ringing sound to tissue and organs beneath the tissue that are healthy. And when you get to an area in which the tissue is disturbed or there's some sort of infection or other disease process that manifests at that place in your body, you get kind of a deadish thump to the sound. You won't get the clear ringing sound. So Abrams was skilled in this. So his practice, he regularly did this percussive work to determine what was wrong with the patient, you know, and to help them diagnose. And in the course of doing this, he began to notice things. One was that he had a patient who had a cancer on his lip. And he was percussing his abdomen, and he found that a particular spot in the person's abdomen would have this deadened thump sound And yet, he found that if the man was orientated in a particular position, namely standing up and facing the west, he would get this dead end sound. But if he had the man rotate, you know, let's say 90 degrees to that, the sound wouldn't be deadened. It would be clear. And this really stumped him, and he's wondering why. So he tried him in different positions and was able to repeat this phenomenon. He noticed when this particular patient faced west that he would get this, you know, this phenomena. So he started to do experiments and found out in time that he could actually get a healthy individual, let's say a young man, who could act as a surrogate for the patient. Now, in the beginning, of course, in some cases, Abrams was working on a patient who was bedridden, and to do this thumping, the patient had to stand. So he connected a wire to a healthy man who did stand, and between that and the patient, and he found that this thumping phenomena would be transferred along the wire. So he started to discover that he could get a specimen of the patient in question, let's say a sample of blood, which was the most common way it was used. You just put a blood spot on a piece of blotter paper, and that would act as a representative of the patient. Now, you could use other things. Subsequently, it was discovered that any physical part of the patient, the hair, for instance, or a fingernail, or a piece of skin, etc., would be a satisfactory substitute for the party instead of using blood. But you can use blood or saliva. That's another easy way. And this substitute in this work is called a witness. So it was Abrams who pioneered all these discoveries. And he found that with a blood sample or saliva or, you know, some hair from the person, he could use a young man as the surrogate to do the thumping on the abdomen and essentially diagnose people from a distance. People started to send Abrams, a sample of blood, you know, blood spot or hair or even fingernails through the mail. And I should say fingernail clippings. And he could use this along with the healthy young man, and so he began to do this diagnosis work from a distance. But as time went on, he began to realize there's something really unusual going on here, because he realized that by developing a certain type of simple machine, he could amplify this energy that the patient was supplying with the witness, and that the young man who they were doing the healthy young fellow who they were doing the percussive test on the stomach, he found that he could simplify the procedure by, instead of tapping the stomach, because he was trying to teach this to other doctors and students, some of them couldn't do the percussive work. He found that rubbing a glass rod along the abdomen stroking a glass rod would produce a similar phenomena, and that they could in fact get this rod to kind of stick, as it were, to the skin when they got what was then called an electronic reaction of Abrams, or it was simply abbreviated the ERA. And because, you know, this was all occurring in the early 1920s, and radio, you know, AM radio, for instance, was just taking off at that time. There was a lot of interest. People were just starting to get, you know, AM radio receivers in their home. It was a big subject at the time. So they kind of linked this phenomena to, somehow they're thinking there's some sort of radio waves that are somehow involved in this process, because he found out by amplifying this signal that came from the witness, and he could actually send a broadcast to the patient, who might be hundreds or even thousands of miles away, and the patient because he had the witness of the patient's body, as it were, to tune into, was able to, you know, positively react to the therapy that was being broadcasted to him. And this was a remarkable development. Now, Abrams began to talk about this. He did lectures. He wrote books. He wrote a book that talks about new pioneering experiments and diagnosis. I think he might have done that book as early as, probably 1917, 1918, 1919, 1919. He was really doing quite well in this area. And he became, you know, more famous as, you know, we got into the early 20s. So by 1923, he was doing lectures. And there was a woman here in California whose name was Ruth Drown, who was later to become probably the next big name in line to take up the torch of radionics research. Well, anyway, Ruth Drown attended one of the lectures that Dr. Abrams gave at the Edison Institute. There was a, you know, the Edison Electric Company was a big deal company at that time. Ruth Drown became a worker for the company, and in 1923 she attended a lecture. It was, the lecture was about radiotherapy given by Dr. Abrams. She assumed it had to do with classical radio work, which she was studying and becoming more adept in, but in fact she found all about this new phenomena that was not given the term radionics by Abrams, because Abrams never used that expression. He simply called this work radiotherapy, but others in the field, including Ruth Drown herself, assigned it the name radionics, and that's the word that has stuck to this day.
Now, what if I can interject something here? What strikes me, because I'm quite familiar with this myself personally.
Yes.
And you can attest to the fact that there's on more than one occasion I've sent you energy while you're
yes.
on the airwaves.
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel that energy?
Yes. Well, it's hard to say if I, felt it in a very, let's say, conscious way, but overall.
Did you feel the results of having?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So
yeah.
Overall, you know, you notice that, you know, you're doing okay. So, you know, I'm not very good at psychic detection anyway. You know, I'm kind of weak in that area, but some people are very sensitive, and they know it right away.
Yeah, well, the point I wanted to make, though, and we can go to the Bible. There are numerous accounts, also in the secret scripture, from the writings of Barnabas.
Who, yes.
Barnabas's a character that was on TV when we were kids right. here
That's
in right. Ohio. Barnabas. Basically had a photographic memory and transcribed all of what he witnessed of the miraculous healings. And he described the prayer that Christ would engage in, always beginning with thanks, and then just making a very positive determination that the individual he was healing, we'll say, and giving thanks for that it had already occurred even before the person realized it. And so all these miracles were produced. There are many people I know that have that gift that can talk to you on the phone or, read a letter or look at a picture and tell you the same thing. And I've done that quite often with people. And the healing aspect, you make the connection. If the person intends to be healed, if it's truly in their heart to be healed, they will be healed. And the person, for lack of a better term, doing the healing is tuning into that energy you're calling it. Now, it became radionics, or it was labeled radionics with Abrams, but it existed for thousands and thousands of years here. And it still does, whether we put the term on it or not. That's the only point I want to make.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's completely valid. Of course, what we had with Abrams was we had a guy who was a conventional scientist. I mean, he was reared in the conventional sciences. Let's say he was an advanced person. He was obviously intellectually advanced, and he accomplished, you know, a great deal of academic merit at a very young age. So it's an indication of his, you know, his abilities. And he, you know, was interested in science, and he was also a dedicated physician. And he just began to observe these things as a science phenomena. And as he went along here, he started to pioneer, or let's say, break new ground.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that when anyone does that, who, goes against
the grain,
let's say the grain of the past, you know, he always has a tremendous uphill battle. I forget where I read it, but I read a quote in which some famous person had said that every time a pioneer tries to forge a new path, he always has to face 1,000 guards of the past. And it's true. You know, you mm-hmm. always have this reactionary result when you try to break new ground, because you have those who have entrenched positions, careers, titles, and positions that's all hooked into, let's say, established dogma. And once you present something new, it's the case always. It's been no other way it's been happens is that the vast majority are not open-minded to the new information. The vast majority bucket completely. And this has been going on, you know, from the time of Galileo and long before that. And I think it was Wernher von Braun who said, when someone breaks new ground, it's not that the established science, academia and science guards, if you will, agree with them. No, they simply die off. And new scientists that are brought up being exposed to the new information are the ones who, you know, are open to experimenting, et cetera. So it's never a case like the old guard says, you know, just applies intelligence and open-mindedness and says, oh, yes, well, isn't this interesting? No, no, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 99% of them fight it tooth and nail. So we have to recognize that.
That's
the nature of.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you were describing this process, you know, the rod and the fingers, the tapping on the fingers, with the tension, of course, placed over, let's say, the abdomen. And I've seen doctors do this. I've had a doctor do this to me before. He said, wow, what's that music? And I said, can I get a witness?
You were going to slip that one in there somewhere.
I looked up the word empath in my dictionary because I know what an empath is. I am an empath. And the most ridiculous definition of the word empath is in my dictionary. It begins with noun, chiefly in parentheses, chiefly in science fiction. Okay, so that sets the stage now for what an empath is. In other words, it's going to, they're implying that this is fictional, that it's not real. A person with the paranormal ability to get this, apprehend the mental or emotional state of another individual. I don't know that apprehend is the right word. I think of the police apprehending a criminal.
Yeah, it could also mean learning, though.
Well, yes, but
tuning into when you apprehend something, you grasp it.
I understand that. I understand that. But I think it is a feeling, okay? Empathy is a feeling. Mm-hmm. And it's a feeling of understanding. It's actually a very positive way for a person to be, as opposed to being sympathetic. Because sympathetic, you take on the emotions. Or sympathetic, you take on the disease. If you're into, you know, miraculous healing. Mm-hmm. Empathy in that sense is to feel and sense and to understand and to even affect that condition, okay? And it goes beyond emotional states or mental states. Empathy is physical as well. Absolutely physical. There's no doubt about that. So this is a lousy computer dictionary, you know. But the point I want to make is, even in the definition of what the word means, they're twisting it. Why is it, if you can grasp the mental or emotional state, let's say that that's what it really means, that you can grasp the mental or emotional state of another individual, why is that science fiction? Why does that have to be science fiction? You see, the word fiction makes the definition of fiction, and it's certainly not scientific. You know, this is the propaganda that the medical community has brainwashed people for thousands of years. Tens of thousands of years on this planet. So every time someone or something comes along that is a pathway to healing, to wholesomeness, to sound health and happiness, they can't stand to have it around. They can't stand to have that person that brought that information forth be successful in what they do. So just wanted to make that point.
Yes, good. Well, what I'll do in the remaining 15 or 20 minutes or so we might have of this conversation is I'm going to take a moment here to just explain why I'm bringing up this topic. It's a very important topic because once you understand the principles behind radionics, you can come to realize that you can use a device. It's called a radionics machine, and there's different models of them and designed by various people. But to learn how to apply this knowledge and get very real results, here's are the sort of results you can obtain by learning, becoming knowledgeable in the art of radionics, is that you can diagnose the condition of a person from a distance, including yourself, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find out a great deal of information about what's going on in virtually every organ system of the body, and not only the physical organ systems, but even emotional systems of the body. You can detect how, for instance, certain psychological functions of fear, anxiety, etc., might be impacting the health of an individual, because there's a way to use these devices to determine this information. So you can both determine it on a qualitative and a quantitative basis. If you learn about this art, you can also, besides diagnosing, is you can send an energy back. It doesn't have to be a physical therapy. In other words, you don't have to take a substance like a herb or a drug, but rather you can send an energy signature back to somebody that matches, or let's say, antidotes the problem they're facing. For instance, let's say you had someone who had malaria. You could detect that with a radionics device from a distance. The person could be on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you knew what was going on with the body, you could take, for instance, a reagent of quinine. You know, quinine is a well-known drug that counteracts the effects of malaria. And you can insert that reagent in the machine. The machine would pick up the energy signature of the quinine and couple it with the witness of the patient who might be, you know, on the other side of the world, and send that healing information through this highway of energy that would go from the machine to the party on the other side of the world and effect a therapy that would be similar to the person actually physically taking the quinine, you see?
Mm-hmm.
So we're not doing anything on a physical level, but rather we're kind of sending energy emails, if you will, over this very special highway. And so not only can you diagnose from a distance, but you can apply therapies from a distance.
You know, life is connected to that grid.
Exactly. Right. This is very important. Now,
yeah.
I mentioned earlier that Dr. Abrams did this lecture in 1923 that Ruth Drown attended. And from there is where she really began to get serious about looking into all of the aspects. So she became a very sort of dedicated follower of Abrams, but something happened the next year, very surprisingly. Dr. Abrams, at the age of 61, died. Now, I need to look more into the circumstances of his death, but frankly, I'm very, very suspicious, because knowing how knowledgeable he was about the healing arts, and knowing that he could obviously detect his own health conditions, I would think that he probably should have lived a much longer life. And I'm very suspicious, because he was starting to really break out in getting out this information about radionics. He might have been done in. I'm only speculating at this point, but I'm really suspicious now. Anyway, Ruth Drown sort of picked up the torch. She started to work with a doctor, a guy named Strong, who also was schooled in the Abrams technique, and she developed her skills very rapidly, so that by the late 1920s, early 1930s, she had become quite skilled in this art. In the interim, she had moved to Los Angeles. She attended chiropractic school in the 20s and became a doctor of chiropractic. And then all this time, she was continuing her work with radionics. She became really adept at it. She took it to new heights. So she had developed more advanced machines, for instance, than what Dr. Abrams was using. But she used essentially the same technique that he was using. What started out as a percussive thumping of the abdomen progressed to passing a glass rod, or in some cases a rubber rod, over the abdomen, and students could literally get the rod to stop at this point. And that came to be called the stick, STICK. Later on, is that they simply would transfer this activity of eliciting what's called a stick to a smooth, flat surface. And in a radiox machine, it had a coil below the flat surface, and that was called the stick pad on radionics machines. And those who become adept in learning a machine can learn how to rub the fingers of the right hand, usually in a circular motion, or let's say oval motion. And as they're adjusting the dials of the machine, I won't go into the details of what the dials do because it'll take too much time, but as you adjust a dial, you'll hit a point in which the energy will cause your fingers in that pad to engage in such a way that the pad will seem to become sticky, as if it had glue on it. And then there'll be a point in which your fingers like literally stop. Assuming you're practiced at this, you don't get this, you know, ability right out of the box. You have to practice it. But those who do practice it can learn to get a stick. And so what you do is you turn up the dials until you get a stick. That stick is a point of resonance, or it indicates a point of resonance between the witness that you have it's usually called a well on the device, and the dials now will give you important information. The readings on the dial will give you important information to help you not only diagnose, but also offer a treatment to the patient that's being examined. Ruth Drown was able to perfect this art, that she was able to put a unexposed photographic plate in the stream of energy that was coming along this, let's call it the radionics highway, from the patient into her machine. She was able to interrupt the stream of data by momentarily touching it to an unexposed a film. Her father used to be a photographer. She learned from a very young age how to develop and develop a film and make prints and all that. So she was very competent in that area. And she used a very special developing technique, which is different from the conventional technique that's used to develop film. And she was able to get a picture of the patient. What I'm talking about, a picture that looked very similar to what a CAT scan looked like. It looked like a cross-sectional slice, if you will, through the person's body at the area where they were focusing the energy on. So, for instance, if they wanted to get a picture of, let's say, an infected liver, they could put a witness and put the certain dial settings on the machine that focused on the energy in the liver. And let's say they were looking for a particular pathogen. Well, they also had a number, a rate, as it's called, for that pathogen. They could combine this information, and they could specifically discover that pathogen and exactly where it's located in the liver of that party. And she could actually get this to show up on an 8x10 film and naturally print it out. And it's simply amazing what she did. And this, she was doing this in the late 1920s, early 1930s. She called this process radio vision. And I have a booklet that I obtained from Trevor Howard. Excuse me, not Trevor Howard, the actor. I'm thinking of Trevor Constable, the author. Sorry, Trevor, if you're listening. And it's a very important booklet. And it talks about and shows about 30 or so photos made with this film that was exposed in this way. It's called radio vision. So that's a huge leap in diagnostic capabilities. This is in 1929 and 1930. Why haven't you heard about it at all? Well, simply because it's so, let's say, easy to do. It's so inexpensive that it would have put a huge dent into the allopathic medicine industry. And, of course, we know they don't want that. So anything, any healing modality that uses something that's abundantly supplied in nature, you know, like oxygen, ozone, and or let's say a therapy like Rife had discovered in the 1920s and 30s, in which you apply a certain frequency of a EMF wave, could affect healing. No, no, we can't have this become known to the general public, because they might stop paying through the nose for poisons from the allopathic medical industry. So it's been really severely suppressed, this whole topic of radionics in this country. It has far more success in England, for instance, because of Ruth Drown's pioneering work. She inspired others. For instance, there's a guy in England who in the 30s picked up on Ruth Drown's work called, well, I should say probably 30s and 40s, called George Delavar, who did a lot of continued the research and pioneered a great deal. There's another man named Bruce Copen, who also picked up on Drown's work in that roughly that same period, maybe a little bit later, who developed a number of, you know, very interesting and advanced machines. But there's another guy right here in the U.S. who picked up the work of pioneers like Abrams and Drown and others. There was another Englishman named Malcolm Ray, who's also very adept at this. His name, he's an American engineer. His name was Thomas Galen Hieronymus, and he lived to a ripe old age. He lived to 93 years old. He passed away in 1988, but he accomplished some truly remarkable things. And one of them is that he patented a radionics machine in 1949. Now, he didn't call it a radionics machine. He called it an analyzer, an atomic analyzer, because he was able to tap into this, let's say, information highway that we're calling radionics, because radionics, you know, yeah, it comes from the word radio and electronics, of course, mm-hmm. but it has to do with the nature of all materials, all, I should say, things in existence, whether animate or inanimate, radiate an energy field, okay? This is really hard to understand for those of us who've been raised with a conventional education, science education. We're only taught that radioactive elements in the periodic table, the ones that are above lead, emit a radiation. And that's quite true. That's why we call them radioactive, because the radiation will show up on, it'll fog a photographic plate, for instance. So
well, they all radiate. Everything radiates.
Well, there you go. So this is... This is the point we're making. In a conventional education that you get here in Europe, everywhere for 100 years or so, we've been taught that, you know, radioactivity begins with the element, the next element above lead. But the fact of the matter is, and this is something that Walter Russell wrote about in his brilliant book called The Universal One. Universal One was published in 1926. Walter Russell was an amazing man. Anyway, all elements in nature radiate, if you will. And those that are, let's say, lower than lead in the periodic table don't radiate as strongly as the so-called radioactive elements do, and therefore they don't necessarily fog a film emulsion. That doesn't mean that things below lead are not radiating anything. It's just that the energy and the frequency is, let's say, below detection of, you know, a piece of film.
Mm-hmm.
But people, particularly living things, radiate a very complex waveform by the nature of, you know, the fact that you're alive, composed of, you know, many different chemicals and molecules, et cetera, and the living system itself has a unique signature. So it's a very broad band of frequency, very broad, and it's very complex. Simple things, you know, like, you know, a mineral, a rock, et cetera, or iron, example, they still radiate a energy signature, we'll call it, but it's much simpler. There's a smaller bandwidth, but everything radiates this signal. Well, this signal is radiating throughout the universe, so everything in existence is radiating. If you could, let's say, fine-tune the highway, for instance, that leads you to iron, let's say, if you can find a frequency that matched iron, let's call it the radionic frequency, not the conventional electrical frequency. I'm not talking about that now. This is where a lot of people who are studying about this get confused. I am not talking about conventional electromagnetic physics, okay? That's very important to remember that. In fact, many of the aspects of this energy defy conventional third-dimensional EMF, electrical physics, okay? So let's not confuse the two, although sometimes we use similar terms. So anyway, in radionics, people like Thomas Galen Hieronymus was able to more closely define the, let's say, the frequency highway that materials occupy, let's say, in this radionic spectrum.
Their vibrational frequencies.
Yes, right. And what he did is that many others did similar things, Drown and others, but he created through empirical testing, experiment, what are called rate books. So he could find a rate or discover a rate for just about anything, any element. Let's say you're looking for any chemical, any substance that's normally used for healing purposes, let's say an herb or even a drug. It could be a drug. It could be something like quinine. I mean, better to use a nature-based drug rather than a laboratory-created one. But he was able to determine a rate. So he put together these rate books, and they were very interesting, so that a skilled operator, let's say if they wanted to diagnose someone who had a problem, could get a witness of the party. If the party wasn't physically there, they could get a Polaroid photograph, they could get a sample of the hair, the fingernails, etc., and put it in this little cup that's on the machine called a well. And then there was usually a minimum of three dials in most radionic machines. Some machines, like the ones Ruth Drown used, had 9 dials. Some of them, like Bruce Copeland's, might have 12 or 16. But the type that Hieronymus developed essentially had two large dials and one smaller dial for increasing the intensity. And with the two large dials, he was able to locate the location of where the problem was, let's say, with one dial. And with the other dial, he was able to, let's say, tune in or locate where the, or let's say the nature of what the problem was. And he had a rate book and he took notes so that in every case, if he wanted to check, for instance, on the overall vitality of somebody, he would use the witness. And, you know, the person could be anywhere in the world. It didn't really matter. It functioned as if the person was sitting right next to the machine. And Galen would simply set one of his dials on the number 9, the left-hand dial, and the right-hand dial in his machine on the number 49. And that was a rate. Those two numbers created what he called a rate that matched general vitality. And then he's rubbing the fingers of his right hand on this little pad. It's called a stick pad, in a sort of oval shape, and he's turning up a third knob, which calls it an intensity knob, until he gets a stick on the pad. And then that knob will give him a numerical reading. So let's say, for instance, he's doing this action and he gets a reading of, let's say, 150, 160, 170. This is a relatively good vitality reading for somebody. But if he's dealing with someone who's in a weakened state, he might get a reading of 60 or 70 or 80. The lower the number of the reading, the less general vitality the person would have. So he could now go to other rates in his book, and he could check the specific rate of vitality of individual organs. So he can go through the whole body by simply going to the rate book, using the same witness in the well there, and by him rubbing his fingers in an oval shape on this stick pad, get a stick and put a chart together in which this particular party at that time, at that date, at that moment, had these various vitality readings. And he would look at all this data and say, okay, I can see a pattern here. This is low, that's low, that's low. This is usually related to, let's say, heart disease, just to come up with an example here. Then he would take a reagent, some sort of substance that, let's say, hawthorn berry is a good herb that helps to act as a tonic for the heart, just as one example. And he might have a tincture of this, hawthorn berry, which herbalists use all the time. It could even be a homeopathic compound of it. But let's say conventional tincture, and he had that in a little vial. He could put that vial into the well along with the witness photograph, let's say that's in there, and he could check the general vitality of the person again. If, let's say, the person's vitality initially read 70, just as an example, by adding this herbal tonic, he now gets a reading of, let's say, 120. The vitality has increased by 50 points, you see. That's telling him that that reagent, that herb, hawthorn berry, for this particular individual is helpful. And for instance, he could broadcast the frequency of that hawthorn berry to that party. He didn't have to physically send them anything. He could send this information via this radionic highway directly to that guy who might be on the other side of the world, and he would receive the therapeutic benefit as if he took the substance, the physical substance of the hawthorn berry himself. Can you see where I'm getting to on this, the value of this entire system? You can both diagnose and treat from a distance without actually using any physical substances. What you're doing is obtaining information from the patient via this radionics highway, and you're sending back healing energy to the person by the same highway. Now, I'll close with this because I know we're getting near the end of the show.
And I like the comment, too. So,
okay, Hieronymus called this energy eloptic energy. Now, what he did is he combined the word electric and combined that word with optic. Why? Because he saw that this energy observed, or let's say, behaved, obeyed, I should say, many of the rules, if you will, of electricity, but not all of them. And it also obeyed many of the rules, if you will, of optics, but again, not all of them. So he decided to call it eloptic energy. It's as good a term as any. There's many other terms that others have used, but in future talks about this, I'll use the term eloptic to refer to this radionics highway. Okay, your turn.
Well, you brought up a couple of points, and I went over to Wikipedia, and pun intended, and looked up their explanation about the dynamizer, mm-hmm. and the subsequent testing, independent testing that was conducted by a member of Scientific American.
Oh, right.
We can trust Scientific American. This we can trust Popular Mechanics on 9/11.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, the defenders of this this concept included Upton Sinclair, who's described as a radical author. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, by the
way. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the Sinclair family is one of the Illuminati families, too. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's
which
right.
is known, okay? If don't trust me, read Fritz Springmeier's Bloodlines of the Illuminati.
Mm-hmm.
And then they call, and the famously credulous Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. So this is to give you the mindset that this was a very scientific and forensic type of examination. What they did is they submitted, they claimed, first of all, that a follower of Abrams had the ERA machine and was tested and diagnosed that this person was cured of cancer. Now, anyone could make that claim. In fact, they would have bought the machine and pretended like they were going through the procedure and turned around and just told this guy that he was healed of cancer. And he died a month later. And that caused a big uproar, okay, which resulted then in this investigation. Now, the investigation claims that they sent him a blood sample from a Plymouth Rock rooster, and it had been diagnosed with malaria, which is quite possible. Chickens get bitten by mosquitoes. Diabetes, they could have cancer, that also, and syphilis, okay. If the chicken had been around Al Capone, it could have gotten syphilis, okay? The point I'm making here is these are claims that they're making. And they have actually no basis in scientific analysis, yet they make the same claims, or they use the very methods they're accusing Abrams of using. And Why would they fight against a cure for diseases or a way to analyze and diagnose diseases and effect a cure? Why would they do that? Because they're in the business of selling pharmaceutical drugs. They're in the business of keeping people ill so they can come back for more of their drugs.
Yes,
okay,
right.
It's a repeated pattern.
Exactly.
We had this problem now in 2010 and last year in 2009 and 2008 when they were trying to ram swine flu vaccines down everybody's throats and up their rear ends. Okay. And I mean it that way, okay? Because that's exactly what they were trying to do. And we exposed the fraud in the pharmaceutical industries. We showed the connections with all these different companies. And so they do anything to discredit anything that's healing. Now, Ken's not asking anyone to believe this, but certainly research it and keep an open mind because this is a vicious attack on this man's work, especially when you consider the integrity behind it and compare it to the people that were doing this study. the jackasses that came forth to debunk him.
Debunk him.
When you mentioned that you were suspicious that he died under less than honorable circumstances.
Well, I'm just suspicious only because it seemed to me he was too young, and because of his skill, you know, Hazel Parcell was a very adept radionics operator. She lived to 104.
Yeah.
And
Ruth, a point.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, when you said that, I doused that.
Yes,
okay?
And
there was foul play was the first answer that came up. And I without reading this article, I had not read this article, okay? Mm-hmm. Without reading the article, then I asked the question, was he poisoned? And I got a yes, okay? And that's a very easy thing to do because he was being treated for pneumonia, okay? And I asked the typical poisons, but the poison that came up was snake venom.
Whoa.
From a cobra, okay? And that can be introduced into the circulatory system intravenously, okay?
Wow.
Okay, that's what I got. Now, do I know that for a fact? I have to trust the accuracy of my dousing, okay? So you had suspicious circumstances. You sensed it. I sensed it. I went down that path, and that's the information I came up with. They say he died of pneumonia. Now, it's very possible that he did have pneumonia. But he also had snake venom in his veins.
Well, if competent people who feel they're good at dowsing out there, or even psychics, if they want to focus on this issue and see what they get, send me an email. I'd love to hear what others might pick up on this. I mean, a lot of people have real skill at dowsing, and they happen to be listening to this and want to pipe in. By all means, send me an email. I would like to get their take on it. Of course, I've learned to, you know, put a lot of stock in stuff you pick up, but both psychically and with dowsing. You tend to be on the money every time, Don. So that's no reflection on your ability, because I know you're way up there. But it'd be interesting to hear if other people got similar results.
Yeah. Well, you know, this whole story, if you just look at it, you step outside the box and look at it, why are they attacking the man's credibility? Why don't they become interested in learning about it to see if it really works?
Right.
Like they claim they test vaccines, and like they claim with the billions and billions of dollars that they collect over the years for curing muscular dystrophy or cancer. I mean, it's the biggest hoax ever perpetrated on humanity.
Right.
They're creating the conditions for cancer.
That's right.
Okay. And I've announced to my audience, and I have to come up with a date, but I'm going to have a man, Dr. Tullio Simoncini from Italy on the show, who spent 3 years in prison for treating cancer patients.
Wow.
Successfully. With sodium bicarbonate.
Wow. Right.
Okay. That's a humdinger of a cancer cure right there.
Yes. Right.
Okay.
And if I may, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, certainly, I mean, they sell that sodium bicarbonate in the grocery stores.
Right.
What's illegal about it?
Exactly. Right. I just wanted to add, since you brought up about Abrams, you know, I've read much of Abrams' biography. While he was alive, he did have people, people were sending him blood samples to analyze, you know, they're putting a drop or two of blood on a blotter paper and sending it to him. And in many cases, he had people intentionally send him, to try to deceive him, animal blood samples, and he could detect it every time. He says he, you know, had the greatest pleasure in sending the sample back to the party and informing them what particular animal the sample came from. So he himself, because of his, you know, skill in using the machines that he developed, was able to tell no problem the difference between human blood and mm-hmm. animal blood. I might also say that they used the same ploy to entrap Ruth Drown. They sent, you know, in the business we call this a ringer, someone who's intentionally sent in to pose as a patient, et cetera. And she had, this was in the early 60s, probably around 1962, 62. She had a young woman come into the office claiming to be a mother and gave her some blood samples, et cetera. And the government claimed that there were samples from various animals, chickens, pigs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What we don't know is we don't know if that's true. Just because the government's claiming this doesn't mean it's true.
Mm-hmm.
If the only way we could know, have to, you know, determine that is to actually have the original blood sample, which is not possible. So just because they reported in the news, you know, they at the time they reported, we have no idea. It might have been human blood, and they simply said it was animal blood as the pretext to arrest her. Because in Ruth Drown's case, they've, you know, she had two trials. She had one in the 50s, in which she, you know, essentially was drug into court because, quote, she was selling interstate medical devices without, you know, interstate, right? Because someone mm-hmm. from another state drove to California, picked up a machine, and drove back to their home state. Now she's supposedly violating an interstate commerce law. So they used that as the pretext. And because of that trial, she spent some time in jail there. That trial, essentially, she was under a prohibition from continuing to do this work. So when they you know, set her up again in the early 1960s for another trial, and you know, she died in prison. She was awaiting trial. They wouldn't let her out on bail because they said she had violated her, quote, probation from the first trial, which took place, you know, 10 years earlier. I'm very suspicious about her too. I mean, she wasn't that young. I think she was 71. But
there are no coincidences.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. They, you know, when they get you in jail, there isn't an easier place to kill you than in jail.
Yeah.
There's no question Wilhelm Reich was killed in jail.
And for, you know, in closing, Ken, for anyone that doubts that energy can be perceived and interpreted and understood and transmitted as well,
yeah,
the government currently, through their military-industrial complex, targets individuals with the weaponized versions of
yes.
this technology. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about it in past shows, and I'm sure we'll talk about it on other shows. Mm-hmm. But this is, you know, while they'll debunk the person doing the healing, they'll deny that they're doing the murdering.
Yes, of course.
You know, talk about the pot calling the kettle black.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show, and I look forward to your next visit on Evident Footprints, which will be next Wednesday, the 21st of April.
Okay, well, I look forward to it. Thanks, Don. We'll probably pick up this conversation about radionics. There's a lot more to cover beyond what we talked about tonight.
Yes. Okay. Well, I appreciate that, and I encourage anyone, just Google the name Dr. Albert Abrams. And you can throw the word radionics in there as well, and you'll come up with a lot of interesting information. And I can tell you that my own gifts and my research into music, this is another dimension of the same ability to heal. We're awakening to who we are, and we certainly can learn from those that created and trailblazed a pathway for us to follow, despite the corrupt organized crime element that would want to stop this information from getting out. It's coming out, and it's going to keep coming out. So, Ken, I wish you a great evening, and look forward to your visit next week.
Thanks, Ben.
Folks, that about wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. A special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world and blogtalkradio.com as well. Also like to thank Don Newsom for the sound tonight, and Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow night when our special guest will be none other than Elder Hale. And we're going to be talking about healing and some solutions for the coming times. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.